Welcome to the McGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, themcguffinman.com, and keep up to date with all of our most recent podcasts. We recently talked about Double Indemnity, Poltergeist. Before that was Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Some in one episode, and Blade Runner 2049 before that, and then American Vandal. So yeah, themcguffinman.com. Check out all 300 of our previous episodes if you so desire.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes.
Here we are. Episode 302 or something of that sort.
Okay.
We're not huge on analytics here at the MacGuffin Men.
No, we're not.
Yeah, we're more about the feel of the game than the numbers.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we're talking about our second Craig T. Nelson joint.
I mean, I would be surprised if he hadn't shown up somewhere in a movie along the way. You know, I mean, it's certainly our second recent Craig T. Nelson. You know, just like 3 years from now, we might not remember that Craig T. Nelson is in Injustice for All. You know what I mean? I feel like there's another like stealth Craig T. Nelson appearance in our episodes.
Well, you've let the owl out of the Pacino. We are talking about And Justice for All. A rare lowercase ellipsis starting title.
Yep. A rare inspired a Metallica album title movie.
I did so much research on this movie before figuring out I was reading about a Metallica album.
I didn't know James Hetfield was in this picture.
No, we're talking about Injustice for All. Your Pacino interest has yet to secede, so
yeah.
we will continue.
I mean, this is one of the last ones we've got left. I mean, from his golden age, this and Serpico are pretty much the only really good movies that we haven't done, and I don't know that we'll ever do a Serpico podcast.
Okay, and so what do you define as his good era? I mean, this is 1979, but this is the tail end of his golden age.
Yeah, it basically all comes to a crashing halt with Cruising, which is the next year, 1980, when his just sort of like run of magic sort of runs out. Like Al Pacino in the 70s is basically Michael Jordan in the 90s, but the acting equivalent, because he's got the first two Godfathers, Dog Day Afternoon. Despite what I just said about us probably not doing an episode on Serpico, he's amazing in Serpico. There's this movie and Justice for All, and not only are these all fantastic movies, but he's like just so good in them, and good in varied ways. Like even Godfather 1 and Godfather 2 are like very different feeling performances and are both spectacular in different sort of ways, I'd say.
Yeah, and I didn't realize till just recently that Cruisin' is pretty well understood as the certain end to it all, eh?
yeah it's him and William Friedkin both made a miscalculation with how people think about gay people, I guess, or how people would view how that movie thinks about gay people. I don't know.
Okay, yeah, because this
Let's just not talk about Cruising. Let's just move on.
Okay. Well, I mean, we can talk about that as a way into this movie where he does play someone who is very much looking out for people who are sort of powerless in the society, and that comes in a few different forms, and not just that, but also going against the people who do have power in society, and in this case the legal profession. So it kind of fits in with what you can imagine they were going for in Cruising. That'll be the last time I mention it. But this is a you know, socially conscious movie that is trying to say something. I just don't know how much you think it succeeds.
I think it succeeds pretty well. I think the thing that because I remember the first time I watched this movie was probably like 8 or 9 years ago, and I was really surprised at how like modern the tone of the screenplay feels. It jumps from comedy to drama like on a dime pretty frequently, and just the way that it's all set in a courtroom, but it's not all the way a comedy. Like there are some very dramatic moments in this movie that I think are very effective, and some very comedic moments in this movie that I think are very effective. And that sort of balancing act in a movie that looks so I don't know, there's nothing like explicitly stylish about this movie visually, that it just sort of feels odd for the time period to have such a normal looking movie feel so off kilter, you know?
Yeah, so is it that movies in the 70s where you feel were very strictly comedy or strictly drama, and this is one that walks the line in a way that not a lot of them do, as it seems to suggest they do now?
Sort of. Like, the way that this movie does that feels more like how it could happen now in a... I mean, one thing that this movie just reminded me of so much is just television, just because there are modern television, because there are so many characters in this movie and so many like small plot lines that happen in this movie that it, like, now, and I know it's just popular to say that so many of these movies, if they were to be made now, would just be 10 episodes on HBO or whatever, but this movie more than most of the 70s movies that I like so much feels that way. It feels like a very, like, despite the fact that we don't visit a lot of different environments, it feels like a movie with a whole world around it, and I found that very interesting. But to get back to what you were asking about with the tone, I don't necessarily think it's something that didn't exist at the time, because I mean, we've talked about The Graduate repeatedly as one of my favorite movies, and that is a movie that also really jumps tonally, but like, it gives you visual cues that what you're dealing with isn't really reality. Like, there's just an element of style to The Graduate that isn't in And Justice for All. And Justice for All looks like every other courtroom drama, but like, when you actually listen to what's being said, it sounds different, you know?
Yeah, and so this assessment, which you're right, I do hear people say about movies now, or movies then, that, you know, comparing it to the way movies and television are made now, is that something can feel like a television show, or that it would be a television show. Do you think that's a qualitatively neutral assessment of something, or do you think that means it's a little too sprawling and would have been spread out, or just more about the economics of filmmaking now?
I think it's more about the economics of filmmaking. I think this movie works really well as a film, and I think what I described about it feeling like there's a world around it, like, there's nothing in this movie really that I wish there was necessarily more of, like all of those different elements that I'm thinking about, like the guy on the car phone at the beginning is a small element of the movie. McCullough is a small element of the movie. Ralph is a small element of the movie, and Jack Warden's character, the judge, a small element of the movie. But all of those different pieces, like, you know, I could deal to have more of them, but I think the amount that we have in this movie is kind of perfect, and it just sort of like continually following Kirkland through all of these weaving storylines, you get a feeling about his life and how sprawling his life has to be and how many things he has to keep track of. And we didn't mention his grandfather either, but just the way that it sort of leads him to this one moment towards the end of the movie where it's just like, all of this is too much. This is just too much to deal with. And my conflicted feelings about what I'm doing all of this for have led me to being out of order, I suppose. And so, like, I don't think, like, qualitatively saying this, I'm not saying this should have been a TV show, because yeah, I don't believe that at all. I think the way that it builds a world that I can sort of like, if that feels very expansive in 116 minutes, is just really impressive.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned the grandfather there. That's kind of the heart of this movie in a way. You know, it's not really a movie about relationships with your family or with your grandparents, but that seems to be the heart of at least our main character, and that he does hold a lot of things dear. And we see, you know, he develops a relationship with a woman throughout this who, you know, obviously didn't mean anything to her at the beginning, mean anything to him at the beginning, because he didn't know who she was. And, you know, we see him kind of grow that relationship, and his relationship with Jay Porter, his partner, is something that exists at the start of this movie. But obviously this thing with his grandpa is something that goes back so far, you know. It's literally his grandfather, you know, he's been his life his whole time, and it's clear he's played a larger role than most grandparents play to people.
Yeah, he raised him and put him through law school.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is something that's obviously so dear to him. He still visits him every Monday, and just as we see things spiral out of control, as, you know, some of his clients are kind of fighting over his time, he's no longer able to treat them all as well as he wants. you know, he misses a few Mondays with his grandfather in a row, and that's, I don't know, that seemed to be one of the things that really breaks him and causes that, we'll say, outburst at the end of the film.
Yeah. Yeah. Important correction, it's Tuesdays, I believe, that he goes to see Grant.
Is it?
I actually do think it's Tuesdays. I don't think it really matters. It's Tuesdays with Grandpa, like Tuesdays with Maury sort of thing.
Oh, okay. You're not just thinking Tuesdays.
Yeah, I don't think I'm that big of a Mitch Albom fan, too. I do find his hair hilarious. I've always been a big fan of that. Yeah, exactly. And also, talking about his grandfather, that's the only part of this movie, the only person in this movie we see him interact, Arthur, interact with, who doesn't really have any relationship to his job. Outside of having encouraged him and helped to make him a lawyer through, you know, being a good grandparent. Outside of that, like, every character that Arthur has a conversation with in this movie is in some way tied to his job. Even the woman he begins dating, who he meets on the job. You know, it's just sort of shows that, you know, he cares so much about his grandfather just because it's the only thing that exists outside of the courthouse to him.
Yeah, and he's obviously proud that he is, you know, in his belief, attending law school, but that doesn't seem to be the central thing. You know, it's not that important that he is a lawyer. You know, as I said, there's those positive feelings and some pride there, but yeah, you get the sense that this is his life. And I think that this is it's a lawyer movie. You know, it's not just a law movie or a legal movie, but this is about how all-encompassing what he's trying to do is. And maybe some people can treat it more like a job, even maybe a job that takes a lot of your time, but is just a job. But he seems to be the central struggle of this is his rejection of fully buying into this institution and playing the role that it seems he needs to play in order to fit in here. You know, his girlfriend tells him to act a certain way that's will cause less friction. He's being blackmailed to act a certain way. And, you know, we see Jay Porter kind of unable to really hold on to it. And it's this mental struggle of him trying to weigh what is important to him in his personal life, what's important to him in his job, and, you know, morally what's important to him in his job. And there are so many times where he could take the easy way out, and there's just so many contradictions about him. You know, he says, you need me because I'm ethical, but you need me to act unethically. There's this constant pulling apart of his character, and I don't mean the Al Pacino's character. I mean the moral character of who he truly is in this film. That's always there and always pressing, and what leads to, you know, the final 6 minutes before he gets to the staircase.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that as you mentioned, like him missing the one element of his life that isn't connected to that by missing 3 weeks with his grandfather is what further drives him to the ending of this movie.
Yeah, and the director, Norman Jewison, who we haven't mentioned yet, in talking about Al Pacino, said it's an unusual role for Al Pacino. In past films like Dog Day Afternoon and even Serpico, he's been the eccentric, cut off from a sane world. This time he's the rational person in the picture. It's everyone around him and his environment that's bizarre. And I think that's absolutely true. And I think especially later in his career, we see the not rational Al Pacino character. But that speaks to what I was saying about him being the one trying to hold things together. He's sort of this this anchor, and there's this, you know, swirling levels of dishonesty and blackmail and criminality with surrounding him in his professional life, and the struggle is him trying to hold it together.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned Al Pacino, so allow me to talk about him for 15 to 20 to 25 minutes.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you if you like the trying to keep it together Al Pacino more than the let's blow it apart as much as possible Al Pacino. But
yeah,
feel free to go with it where you want.
Yeah, no, I love this performance. I think he's great. I think this is one thing that Pacino does a lot now that he never did in the 70s, despite the fact that I think he has a a lot of charisma. Like, he never really just really like laid on the charisma in his performance. He was very like measured in everything that he was doing, whereas now you get a lot of those tics of him. Glenn Ross is the perfect example, where he's still like so good in that movie, but he is doing so much in that movie, but it's all like, all of it's fantastic and entertaining, and he's just like, he's having a conversation, but he's looking around the room and looking at everybody. He's like touching his suit for some reason, and he does all of those little things in this movie where he's just so alive and energetic, whereas in most of the other movies that he did in the 70s, that he was very, very laid back. And this movie, this performance, Arthur Kirkland, is like a movie star role as opposed to the character that stars in the movie. You know, like, it's really hard for me to picture anybody other than Al Pacino playing Michael Corleone, because I feel like he just sort of, I think he molded parts of that movie around him, those first two especially, and same with Dog Day Afternoon. I think that movie, like, I can't imagine it working with another actor as Sonny, and Serpico maybe the same thing, but like this movie, it feels like it was a part that was more malleable, and since it just so happens that you got the best actor in the world to play that part, so it's the best case scenario, you know, because I just think he's so charming in this movie in a way that you never see him just be charming, you know, and at least in this period of his career. Like, there's a scene in this movie where he just smiles and laughs, and I'm just like, that's like a movie star thing. It's wonderful, you know?
Yeah, usually when he plays, I was trying to figure out the wording of this, usually when he plays that confident person, it can be kind of arrogant, or mm-hmm. with Michael Corleone, especially eventually, just very menacing. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, I feel like he has a self-assuredness, even despite how frazzled he is in so much of this, because he's trying to pull off so much, and because those forces acting on him and pulling him in different directions. He seems sure of what he's doing, and he seems, you know, like, this woman will say yes to the date, even if has to change the time a few times.
And him saying, want a drink at the water fountain.
Yeah, that's great, too. I just don't find him to be, you know, super cocky. I do think that charming's the right word. I think he's just got that, you know, he's a handsome, charismatic person doing what a handsome, charismatic person could do. And, yeah, I think it's interesting to think about this as somebody else, because it is a role that could fit other people, and I was doing that while watching it. You know, a Paul Newman or a Robert Redford, or just somebody else who would be big enough around this time, who might have maybe some of the same politics, or someone who would want to be seen in the way that this character is eventually seen. Mm-hmm. You know, standing up for the little guy and speaking out against these institutions in this big way. And yeah, I think it's, I may not have realized it at the time, but I think you're right. It's such a movie star role that it is possible to kind of pick and choose who could have done it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But I think since it is Al Pacino, despite how much I love Mr. Redford and Mr. Newman, and I'm on record many times as saying so, but like,
approximately 302 times.
yeah, exactly. The last 30 minutes of this movie is where, like, Al Pacino's, like, skills that we all know about sort of start to take hold and become very important. Like, he looks and feels so run down at the end of this movie, in a way that I can't quite, like describe, but it just happens, and it looks like he is broken, despite the fact that, like, an hour ago he was just being charming and at a hearing saying, why are we using microphones, and it being so funny. But he just looks like physically just so run down. Like, knowing Al Pacino in the 70s, he probably didn't sleep for the 2 weeks they were shooting those scenes or something.
And you don't know if he's sweating or crying. Like, there's water on his face. I still can't place what it is, but it's not the sign of like a healthy, happy person.
Exactly. And I think that's where that's where it really helps to have somebody of Al's caliber. Whereas with Robert Redford, you'd be losing a little something in that last 20 minutes.
He'd still try to be a little too charming, or still try to look good, or what?
I mean, Robert Redford's just like he's an okay actor. Like Robert Redford's an A-plus movie star who has moments of good acting, but for the most part, he's an okay actor. You know, yeah. Like the highs are really again the comparison point is always Brad Pitt. It's the same with Brad Pitt. The highs are really high, but there's a lot of mediocrity in the middle. You know.
I trust Brad Pitt more with the eating scene at Griffith's apartment, though.
Yeah. He would have knocked that out of the park. Egg roll would have been thrown into the living room. It would have been great. What do you mean you won't trade me Venafro? Throws the egg roll.
We were talking a little while ago, you and I, outside of this podcast, as we tend to do sometimes, mm-hmm. About, you know, we talked about Cruisin' being sort of the end of this magical run for 70s Pacino, and we heard some other people talking about film saying that once Scarface happened, he was never able to play things small again. You know, he wasn't able to rein it in after what he did there. Do you think that's true? And a similar question, is this different if it's after Scarface?
I think you can really see the seeds of where Pacino went, because this is a bigger performance than Sonny or Michael Corleone. I'm not having, like, the Godfather wires aren't just twisted in my head and I'm calling him Sonny from Dog Day Afternoon because of James Caan in The Godfather, right? That his name in Dog Day Afternoon is Sonny, right?
Yes.
Okay. but yeah, and so Scarface is, I don't know, it's hard to figure out where he was going, but you can see this gradual growth towards him just wanting to be you know, like over the 70s he's slowly figuring out, okay, everybody's here for me, let's start giving them roles that are just me, like I'm the main attraction. And Scarface is the textbook example of a movie that is only worth watching for its lead. And I think I don't know what happened, but he got really into sort of just playing into all of his tics. And I think Vincent Hanna's in Heat is the best example of the character from the 90s, where it's still like it's 90s Al Pacino, 90s and afterward Al Pacino, where he's very over the top, but it still works and is a great movie. And I don't know, it's just, I think he just got enough accolades from being big that he just kept going bigger, and then got to a point where he was like, cool, I'm just big now, this is just what I do all the time. You know, and you can even see it in The Godfather 3, like he plays Michael Corleone in a grander sort of way in that movie. You know?
yeah this, I mean, we talked a bit about how it's a movie star role, but it's not that big until the end, and like his performance, I mean. And I just don't feel that this movie coalesces as much as it sounds like you think it does. Like, I'm okay with having some exposure to his life. You know, I don't need to be, I don't, this doesn't need to be 12 Angry Men all taking place in one room or anything. Mm-hmm. I just feel like it's too disjointed, and I think it feels like it comes together in the end a lot better than it does while you're watching, you know, while you're sitting through it, because I think the ending's just so strong and so entertaining. And we finally get all these characters in one room, I guess, mm-hmm. except for Grandpa. I'll agree that it jumps from comedy to drama sometimes, and I'm very much a fan of mixing those two genres. I just don't think that it's done successfully, and I'm willing to admit a big part of this could be the music. I honestly think, like, not even as a joke, but I think that just some of the musical choices and how zany it is really, really throws me for a loop. And I know that it's not this big choice in the time period to have your music sound like that, mm-hmm. but I just don't think that they intertwine as much as they need to.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the music is shit. I will not disagree there. It's like 70s sitcom music, you know?
Completely.
And it's just bad and doesn't help the movie in any way. And as you said, it actively hurts the movie. I think I do see what you're saying, and I think there is a part in the movie where it takes a bit of a jump where things stop feeling so like as smoothly connected. And it's a, right around when it's right after the plate scene, when Jeffrey Tambor, Jay, is going to the hospital and Arthur goes with him, and he talks the eventual police captain from Die Hard 3 into going to Ralph's hearing for him. That is when scenes sort of start to feel disjointed, just because like right after that we have this scene with this character who we barely know, sitting across from somebody I think we've seen for 3 seconds previously, and like that scene really jumps out. It has to exist to show you why he's late for the hearing. But it's still, that's a real jump, and then right to the hearing with Ralph is a real jump. Like that scene is very hard to watch, I think, in a like a positive for the movie way, just because it's so like it's so heartbreaking. But like though the jumps from Jay and the plates to this dinner to this hearing are just very, it's very jagged. And also I don't know that we haven't seen a scene without Arthur yet, but I feel like we haven't, you know, and just that just doesn't feel right. And then you go immediately to Arthur attacking the car and just telling him that Ralph has died. And just all of those things happen so quickly, and those things don't totally coalesce, I think is where the movie sort of loses it. And so I think I agree with you. I just think it happens a little bit earlier, you know, like it goes off the rails a little bit, and then we just sort of get back into Arthur's story. And I think it comes together for the ending.
Okay. Yeah.
Like it takes these necessary side roads that are way bumpier than you want them to be. But I think where it ends up is worth it.
Yeah. And I do think it's, for me, that's a combination of a screenplay problem and a filmmaking problem. Mm-hmm. As I said, the music, and I won't harp on it again because I know I don't have to change your mind about this. Yeah. And I don't think I have to change anyone's mind who's seen it in the past 10 years. Yeah.
Dave Grusin, we're calling you out.
Shots fired. So that's really jarring for me. I think the helicopter scene is just unnecessary.
I take issue with any scene with Jack Warden being deemed unnecessary.
Okay, I'll give you that. I see what Pacino is doing, and I think with the music, it makes his performance look really goofy there, mm-hmm. even though that's how you would act if you thought you were going to die in a helicopter crash. But it's just, I don't know, though. Jack Warden, again, like he's great and he's hilarious, but I just don't think that he's supposed to be in this movie, or at least he's not supposed to be. That scene's not supposed to be in this movie, and because he's fine and everything else. Am I missing something on the suicide attempts constantly?
It's that he is a man at the top of the system that is just continually trying to get himself out of it, and the way that he views as the way out of it is by killing himself. Like it's just sort of yet another, the justice system is very depressing and there's no way out except death or betraying all of your beliefs, you know?
Okay, so is that funny? Is that a joke? Like, do you laugh at that? Or is it just Jack Warden's there?
I 100% laugh at when he fires a gun in a courtroom.
I'm not up for cutting that out of the movie. That
no, needs, because yeah. That's fantastic. I think it's just sort of the... I think it's more the... Just sort of trying to show an absurdist sort of way of how... a character that can be played by Jack Warden can fit into this sort of like half dramatic, half comedic world. Is it highly sensitive? No. But I don't know. It doesn't jump out as me as a problem, just because I think the rest of this movie exists in a version of reality that doesn't remind me of my own, you know, or yes. Mostly doesn't. You know?
Right. And so we've kind of had this spectrum set up and he's just on the zaniest end of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that's what he is. Him and the grandpa, Lee Strasberg's character, are like different ends of the same sort of thing. Like they're both people closer to the end of their life than Arthur. And I know Jack Warden looked 60 by the time he was 20, but like I don't know how old he actually is in this movie. I don't think he's grandpa, quite grandpa's age, but like They're both sort of losing.
He's a judge. They're not young.
Yeah, yeah, that is true. He's just sort of, his life has led him to this place, and he doesn't really see a way out of it, and he desperately wants to be out of it. And I think the only way he has figured out that he can get out of it is through killing himself, and he's just continually failed to do so.
Okay. Mm. And would I feel different about this if the suicide attempts weren't kind of silly, like the trying to shoot himself in the head with a rifle? Because I think the idea of him when he was eating his lunch on the ledge, and then, you know, it's pointed out that he does kind of want to kill himself. I enjoyed the notion then. Like, I think that was, that did something for me and kind of brought me back into the fold a little bit.
Yeah.
But I guess just some of the gaggier ones just threw me off. And I think just
well, what else is there? There's the helicopter and then the rifle, right? That's it.
Yeah, yeah, but the helicopter's a big one for me because it's a big long scene, it goes on for a long time, and it's just all the, okay, last time I'll say, all the music and going under the bridge and the reaction shots. I think that there's a way to do that, you know, to have him kind of play with his life like that, to have you know, to have the characters around him notice that and talk about it, and even at times be scared of their own lives, mm-hmm. Just being around him.
Yeah.
But I think that it's so, it doesn't fit in at all to me. And I think that's one of the ways I think this movie just isn't as tight as it could be, because I think that this is a movie that could have been a great movie, and mm-hmm. I don't think it's a great movie.
Okay, so what you're saying about the helicopter scene is that in theory it works, but in practice it sucks.
Yes, I guess.
Okay. All right. I think, yeah, I don't think this movie is a great movie, and there's a reason why we did Dog Day Afternoon and Two Godfathers before we got around to this one. You know.
Yeah.
But I think it's so close in a way that is, I think, again, experimental, or at least mildly experimental for the decade, tonally, that I think it's fantastic. Like, I mean, if you were to put somebody else in this movie, like somebody other than Al Pacino in this movie, who knows how I would react, but Al Pacino is in this movie, ipso facto. I love this movie, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it says something that his closing speech, as misquoted as it is still quoted. Mm-hmm. I think it does say something about the lead up to that and the execution of it and Pacino being who he is. There's a reason why something like that sticks around. I think this could be one of those movies like the Verdict or another courtroom movie that I know that's not a huge movie for a lot of people, but just a movie that even if it's smaller and more forgotten is just tighter and more enjoyable and communicates what it wants to say more successfully. I'm okay with satire and absurdity, and I think that, I don't know if it just doesn't go far enough or it goes too far, but I find it somehow misses the mark.
Okay, yeah, I get that. I mean, unquestionably The Verdict is a better movie than this, but The Verdict has a I think an easier road to being a tight movie just by the fact that it's just a straight ahead drama, you know, like this is just, yeah. It's just, this is a type of film that is just so, and Justice for All is the type of film that's just so hard to control. And whenever somebody's able to pull it off, it's amazing. It's just so uncommon, you know, it's why, yeah. Veep is amazing. Cause they do this every week, you know?
Yeah. No, admittedly this tries a lot more than The Verdict did try. So,
yeah, The Verdict is like a lot more movies that you had seen before 1982 or whenever that movie came out. Whereas I feel like Injustice for All in 1979, there were way fewer movies that remind you of that tone. Yeah,
and I guess another reason I'm tempted to put it in is, you know, as we said, a movie star, you know, Paul Newman has a big head start at Pacino, obviously, but you know, a big actor and kind of just dealing with that. I think they end in a similar way. Like, this system is broken. I can't fit into this anymore. And dealing with urban crime, and I think that 70s crime wave in New York kind of played out. I know this movie's not New York, it's Baltimore, but just that stuff finding its way into movies, and a lot of movie stars saying, I want to play an interesting dynamic character who fights for those issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and this is Al's interesting dynamic character.
Yeah, and I think maybe I was I didn't know a ton about this movie. I think I was expecting it to be less silly, and I think that maybe I should have known a bit more off the start. I mean, even just from within the movie, you know, the car kind of up on the median, Sherry, his assistant, saying, "Want some coffee?" which I think is hilarious. You know, maybe they were giving me some hints, so I should have been more prepared.
Yeah, well, I mean, that scene with Jack Warden firing the gun in the courtroom, that and the lottery tickets being eaten, that whole sequence is so over the top, and I think that comes at like the 10-minute mark.
Yeah, it's not very deep into.
No, and I think that sequence is amazing. I will say the same thing as you. I was not anticipating the tone of the movie that I ended up getting, because I remember the first time I watched this, and just that by that scene I was like, what the fuck is this movie? Like I thought I was watching a Pacino movie from the 70s, and this is such an outlier. But I think that disconnect that I had in my head made me like the movie a lot more, you know. I think it just had the exact opposite effect on for me, is that since it wasn't what I anticipated, I liked it a lot more.
Okay, yeah, I think this was in a box in my head with A Few Good Men, purely for like linguistic title reasons.
Yeah, this is a better movie than A Few Good Men.
I hadn't seen either, so okay. I just thought they were movies that took themselves very seriously, and I really enjoy the first scene where he's still in prison.
Oh,
and
it's really good.
Is it Negan? Is that the character's name that they bring in?
I just call him Ralph. Ralph Aggie. There it is.
Oh, Aggie. There it is. Yeah, I thought. I mean, it's shot so dark, you know, seeing him just like his urine just coming out onto the floor like that, and seeing how this man was being talked to as he's being kind of walked in, and just the really, you know, I'm saying this in the best way possible, uncomfortable experience of watching someone go through that experience in front of all these people while being jeered at.
Yeah, forced to strip.
Yeah, it's a very grating scene in a lot of ways.
Yeah, all of the scenes with Ralph are so difficult to watch for countless reasons. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, and what you're saying, and you're introduced to the character that you know will become your lead by seeing him in a jail cell. You know, it sets the tone for the type of movie that you had anticipated. And then,
well, and finding out he's a lawyer, but a lawyer who's willing to throw a punch if a cop is, you know, acting exactly. So immorally. Yeah.
He probably yelled Attica while he threw the punch.
Most likely. Yeah. So speaking of Aggie, we touch on some of, I think maybe something else you thought might have been kind of ahead of its time, but with some of the gender and sexuality issues in this.
Yeah, I think I can remember a little bit about having seen this movie the first time from how I reacted to the film's treatment of Ralph, but it was a much different time in our society, so like I wasn't something that I was thinking about as much as I would be today. Whereas now, like every time you see a transgender character show up in a 1970s movie, you just immediately are like waiting for the scene where you just are so uncomfortable with the way that the 1970s talked about transgendered characters. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Dog Day Afternoon.
Well, Dog Day Afternoon is another positive example of that working out, you know? And we probably talked about that on the podcast. Every scene that Ralph was in where the film didn't like, I don't know. And also, like, we're in a period where every day I figure out that there's somebody from Hollywood whose work I can no longer appreciate. And just, like, you're just so in this mindset of just being, of rethinking everything from the past as we see it today. And
is this the last time I can watch a Norman Jewison movie for some horrible depiction?
Exactly.
And
I wasn't really worried about it from Norman Jewison's perspective. Because
from what I know about him, he's not the guy to watch out for.
Exactly. His liberal bona fides are so proven. But I know Al Pacino as somebody that was willing to say, yes, I will star in Cruising, right? So so anything's on the table. And then the way that that Arthur treats Ralph is just very accepting, and he's just a good person to Ralph. And the way that the system treats Ralph is improper, and obviously the way the group of people, the police and the inmates at the beginning of the movie treat Ralph is horrible. But the fact that the movie treats Ralph like a person, I think, is very, very impressive for 1979.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, especially in this movie that I'm saying kind of goes zany or goes for the gags. Like, there's no sight gag. There's no even just like little joke in passing where you're like, oh, I don't know if I would make that joke or if people would make that joke today. It's just, as you said, he's not treated well by everybody in this movie, obviously, but the movie isn't the problem here, right? There's bad things that happen in good movies all the time. No, I think you're right that they just handle it sensibly. And even the system doesn't treat him well, but it's treating him by the letter of the law. It has nothing to do with, I mean, I don't mean in the jail, I mean in the courtroom. It's, you know, we have this finicky judge, but it's a judge who does something like this to seemingly anybody, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also the way that, I'm not crazy about the way the women characters exist in this movie. There is something that, this is such a like a man's movie, just because every character other than Packer that has any sort of prominent role is a man. And even Packer only exists for to have a somebody for Arthur to bounce his conversations off of, really. So that wasn't crazy about, but talking about like worrying about whether I'm able to enjoy a movie anymore is, I forgot that there's a 40 minute of the period of this movie where Arthur is convinced that the judge is innocent of the rape, and I was just like sitting just very terrified that this movie was gonna end in a way that maybe not able to appreciate it anymore. And eventually the way that the movie portrays the treatment of sex crimes in courtrooms, I found very very modern, you know, like he's just so frustrated by it, Arthur is, and I just found that very impressive, you know.
Yeah,
the way that he can just sort of see the way, like he knows that that the judge is guilty, and he knows that he can win his case. But he just, and he's able to see how few opportunities Craig T. Nelson's character is really going to have to win this. And he also thinks Craig T. Nelson is coming to this trial from a problematic place as well. And he just can't deal with the fact that he could free a rapist who has admitted to him that, yes, I did this rape, and I show no remorse for it.
Yeah, and we see Frank Bowers is Craig T. Nelson.
Okay.
And Arthur, when they have their argument in the courtroom before, you know, not in trial, but as they're sort of in another courtroom or nearby another courtroom, mm-hmm. and we see their confrontation happening at the same time as this legal discussion, this trial. And it puts you in that mindset that these trials are often just, you know, kind of a pissing contest, and so much more about personal motivations and political motivations, or blackmail or something totally external to the evidence and the true nature of the accusations and the criminals. And I thought that was, I don't think I had seen that before, which just, it just feels weird because it seems like one that could easily be done to death. But
yeah,
the way that those were cut, I thought was a nice visual metaphor that was right on point with some of the things this movie is trying to say, that the system is so dependent on these things outside of what we think of when we think of the law.
No, exactly. And I think my favorite line in Arthur's big speech at the end is when he talks about how, I know you just told me his name, but Craig T. Nelson's character.
Frank Bowers.
Frank Bowers, how he wants to win. Like that line, I think it might be my favorite part of that speech, just because I think it really encapsulates something that the whole movie is sort of about, and especially with the progression of Jay's character, where a murderer that he knew was a murderer and who he helped go free then ended up killing two other people. And the way that him and Arthur talk about this case that trial where Jay got a guilty man named innocent, about how he played the trial quote unquote brilliantly, you know, and they just sort of have a hard time seeing that there are people at sometimes, you know, it's just like, because this is your job, it just sort of becomes normalized. And the setup of your job is kind of competitive. And so you just naturally kind of want to win because you want to be successful at your job. And the constant problem, it seems, within at least the way this movie depicts the justice system, is remembering that there are people at the end of it. You know, like you are making decisions about people's lives. And that's the thing I like so much about Arthur's continued motivations, is that he just wants to continually remind all the characters in this movie that everybody in this movie is a person, you know?
Yeah, and when it comes to the judges, we see, you know, Fleming is an awful person from the beginning, and nothing ever happens to shake that opinion of him. And again, with Rayford, sometimes there's laughs and stuff, so it's hard to know how we're supposed to feel about him entirely, but it's more of this absurd clown character, right? We don't relate to him. And speaking of not relating, and as you said, these people in the legal profession not being totally aware of the fact all the time that what they're doing is, you know, determining the fate of people's lives, is him swimming in his bubble, you know?
Yeah, oh, 100%. He's swimming in like a fog of his own toxicity.
Well, yeah, first of all, it's just this bubble out in nature, you know? It's we have these natural surroundings and we have this obviously very man-made structure. It doesn't fit it at all. It's completely isolated. He's in there alone. He can't see anything. Sometimes he can't even hear anything. Kind of see no evil, hear no evil, do no evil. And he's doing, he's saying everything you would expect this character to say, you know, that make the crime fit the punishment doesn't work. We need unjust punishment. The concept of rehabilitation is a farce. You know, he can't see for the fog. He can't even see the person he's speaking to. That's how out of touch he is with the very basics of humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he is the most evil of the people in the system that we see in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously he's the rapist.
The first, is it the first mention of rape when they talk about Fleming being convicted in the bathroom there?
Yes. Yes, and that scene makes me very uncomfortable. But I also think that scene is a textbook example of people that can't see that what they're doing is more than just a job, you know? That scene is like a textbook, oh boy, I'm watching a movie from 1979 and I'm real uncomfortable right now, you know?
Yeah, so do you think the filmmakers are kind of siding with the points we've just been making, that maybe lawyers get this distance from it, that a normal person wouldn't say anything like that in that tone ever, but they it means different things to them, so it's this comic moment in their lives. Mm-hmm. Or is it supposed to be a moment that we really enjoy because we're relating with our protagonist and now things are going to get better for him, and you know, in that he has some sort of twisted vengeance against someone who he's having a problem with? What's your take on that? Why does it make you uncomfortable?
I think that one is because that one feels like they were playing it for just comedy, and I don't think they meant anything thematically by it. I think that reading applies, but there's something about that scene that feels like they played it too hard for comedy as opposed to meaning. Like the scales are just tipped too heavily in comedy's direction, and I think that's what makes me uncomfortable. Whereas say, I think the best comparison point for that scene within Jack Warden's storyline is that Rayford's storyline is that the scene with the rifle towards the end, where he's trying to kill himself with the rifle, right? Where we have had some sort of setup that this is a movie where suicide is going to be joked about a little bit, and whether or not that joke works with Rayford, and I think we're both kind of on the side that it doesn't really, at least thematically, that idea that we're going to be using suicide as a metaphor in this movie has been set up. Whereas we haven't really had any introduction to how the movie is going to treat rape. And then this first scene where rape is mentioned, somebody says rape, and then two of the three characters immediately start laughing as hard as they've ever laughed in their lives.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I, that's where the disconnect is. And that's why that scene makes me really uncomfortable. Whereas the last scene with Rayford, with the rifle doesn't necessarily, you know, like there's some sort of establishment of the idea, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, the benefit of the doubt one is that this job can do awful things to people, and this might be how people actually talk about this behind their, like, it literally behind closed doors, right?
Oh,
like
they
check that no one's in the bathroom stalls. They make sure that, you know, they know that this is beyond uncouth to be speaking like this, and that's why they do it in the privacy of the men's room.
Yeah,
and you know, we compare that. So it maybe that, you know, maybe you do laugh a bit. I don't mean you. Maybe one laughs a bit at that the first time through. Maybe even in the late 70s when this is a new movie, and you know, you kind of laugh at that because of the reasons I mentioned. You know, it's a bit cathartic for our protagonists who we're meant to relate with. But then we get to see a rape victim, or we get to see several rape victims throughout this movie. I think the one where Jeff's on the floor and he's got the hostages and he's got the gun and he says, you know, they raped me a bunch of times and other stuff too. And no one's laughing, right? Like no one in the movie's laughing. No one in the audience is laughing. It's just this incredibly heavy moment where instead of getting a third hand account of it, you're speaking directly to a victim. You know, later we see the female victim of rape in the courtroom. She's still bruised and still clearly very emotionally distraught. That maybe it kind of turns the mirror on the viewer a little bit and say, you know, you've kind of done this. You've done this thing that you're kind of admonishing these lawyer characters of doing. You're looking at it from such a distance to when it might mean something good for one person, but deal with the repercussions of what this actually does for the people who are victimized by it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, again, it fits in with the Arthur's like goal in this movie seems to be able to to try and convince everybody around him that everybody else around them is also a person. And that's a scene where we just haven't had enough of the movie established for us to feel totally comfortable laughing about rape. I will say, I bet that scene like played well in 1979, you know, like,
yeah.
And I also have like no doubt that lawyers still talk about rape that way. Like if a similar situation happened today, I bet people would talk about it the same way, you know, like, so like, I mean, I don't think the writers were wrong to do it, but the reason it feels wrong to me as a viewer is because, I mean, my opinions are just so far removed from what it must be like to be a lawyer. And also just there's an established way that I feel like rape can be treated in media with an element of seriousness. And that is maybe the least serious depiction of a discussion of rape that I've seen in a movie that's basically a drama. Yeah.
Yeah.
A zany-ish drama, but still.
Yeah, but still a drama overall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to talk more about the ending? Do you have anything else?
I do want to say, like, just visually, like, there is one, again, very utilitarian movie. I think we probably agree there, other than a few of the bigger visual metaphors that happen, like the bubble that we were talking about with the judge was swimming. And the first scene with Arthur and Bowers. Happening above a courtroom where other trials are going on, and we're sort of cutting in between the two. Those are like really nice moments of direction. But it's just as a whole, I feel like the movie's pretty utilitarian. And I will say, like, so the beginning of the movie, it seems like every shot is slightly not level. Like the camera's tilted just a tiny bit, not so much that you would call it a Dutch angle, but just that it's a little tiny bit askew. And I found that really interesting. As I was watching the movie, I sort of started to figure out I might just have a terrible Blu-ray rip of this movie because it didn't really seem totally perfect and characters seem to be bouncing a little bit too much. But if Norman Jewison and company decided to tilt the cameras just a little bit in that opening montage, make things just a little bit off the level, very smart move, you know?
Okay.
And if not, I still thought it anyway, so congrats, Norman.
There you go.
Yeah. The ending, I mean, I really like the Pacino performance in the last sequence. I don't think there's a lot to say in that conversation other than Pacino's the greatest actor of all time, and that's a scene where he has 8 minutes and everybody has to listen to him, you know? Like, it's a perfect setup for me.
The Frank Bauer speech gets an applause. Come on, people. You just wait.
Yeah, you're going from coach to Michael Corleone. Things are going to step up.
It does tear the house down, though.
Oh, he really does. And just like as he's yelling, I've completed my opening statement, like as he's being pulled out the door, they don't even try and reframe so that we can see him. I thought that was a really cool choice. But just the idea that he just has nowhere to go but where he's trying to, like where he feels the most uncomfortable. Like he just sits on the steps and just sort of sees somebody, in Jay's case, as we've talked about off the podcast, Jay sort of doffs his wig at Arthur to sort of indicate that he's going back to work. He sees a character that was pushed to his breaking point, and as a character, and Arthur is now a character who, like, literally we just watched his breaking point. We just watched him throwing plates in the hallway, like his equivalent of that. Yeah. And all he sees before the end of the movie is, like, he just stumbles to the steps of the place that has kind of destroyed him as a person, and he sees the last person that he saw that happen to walk in, like nothing bizarre is going on. It's just a Tuesday, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not an uplifting ending, I'll say. Also, like, who knows what happens with that trial now too. Like, I don't think what Arthur Kirkland does is necessarily good. It almost seems like if we're trying to look at this trial in a way where he wants to get the judge convicted because he knows the judge is guilty, it seems like the more logical opportunity, or the more logical way to go about it would have been to, like, kind of throw the trial as opposed to immediately force a mistrial, you know, like to sort of know that you're going to win and know how you can make Bowers win. Like, that just, and if there's some sort of conspiracy or whatever and you lose your job, I mean, he was going to lose his job anyway, you know? Like, I think what he did was, like, very entertaining to a viewer, of course. And I think, like, it comes from a good place, but I don't think, I mean, I guess that's the lesson of this movie, is that even with everything he did, I mean, did he accomplish anything, you know?
Yeah, so...
because there's no way there's no mistrial there, you know? Like, no, everything just restarts.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I think it just restarts completely. I think that... Yeah, so it's a bit of perhaps he... You know, maybe he looks great now and he looks like the most ethical lawyer, and that you can't buy this guy with anything and you can threaten him with everything and he'll still stand by his convictions. So this idea that he is the most ethical lawyer, you know, persists. And maybe there is somebody who wants that. This movie doesn't look like there's many of those people inside the legal industry, mm-hmm. but maybe there is some law firm or some government body somewhere that... is admirable of this and will give him a job. And more importantly, and I think more characteristically, he couldn't do anything else. Like, he can't control himself at that point. When he's forced into such a corner, he can't do anything ethically wrong, so he can just do something logically incorrect.
Yeah.
And as counterintuitive as that might seem, his moral fiber doesn't really allow him to do anything else. Even if he wanted to, it's not in him to do that. And then I think that the moment on the stairs where Jay Porter comes back, I think that it is a little bit of what we've been talking about throughout this movie, that it is this level of zaniness that is used to show something rather serious, you know, and it's this absurdity of the system idea that's being played with again. And you know, as Jay Porter walks up the steps, everything looks normal, but it's not. You know, there's this facade. He lifts up his wig, and he's just this guy who kind of lost his mind and shaved his head. You know, that this industry or this profession, it doesn't function properly, and it takes a certain kind of person to do it, I think is what this movie implies, in that sometimes lawyers secretly acknowledge it to each other, just like that bathroom scene. You know, they act in a way that they wouldn't act out in public or out in the courtroom. But there is this kind of open secret that this system is broken, but it's the way that it functions, and it's a system that I can work in and make a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Everything's ruined.
Sure is.
Yeah, and then we get a terrible freeze frame ending. It's real bad.
It's really, really awful.
Yeah, it's not good. I think this is it's sort of a textbook case of my annoyance with. I'm putting it in the Walk the Line Hall of Fame for terrible freeze frame endings.
But you liked this movie up until that point.
Oh yeah, most other frames of this movie, I give a 10 out of 10. It's just that one that they chose as the ending.
Yeah, even, and not even just that it's a freeze frame, but you've somehow made Pacino look bad.
Yeah, yeah.
For that one.
Now I'm upset even more. One thing, I do want to go back to the grandfather, just because it's kind of on the topic of what we're discussing. And I think what you're saying with Arthur not really being able to do anything else, I think that's sort of what his grandfather is supposed to sort of represent in a sort of more metaphorical sense in this movie, is that towards the end of the movie, we see Arthur has missed visiting him 3 times, right? And his grandfather loses track of time because, you know, he could count on Arthur to be there every Tuesday. And, you know, his brain's slipping a little bit as he ages. And Arthur is like the closest thing to a sort of marker of time that he has in his life. And it's just sort of the idea that I think the grandfather is supposed to represent a place where if Arthur doesn't continually go back to it, things are either going to get even worse than they already are, right? Like the justice system is going to lose even more. Like if Arthur disappears for 3 weeks from the justice system, it's going to get even worse, you know? And I think that's sort of the conclusion he might be coming to at the end of the movie, is that he's got to do something, but he also can't leave, you know? He's got to be a part of this somehow.
That there's still the idea of human decency and decent humans are the checks and balances on this system, that the further we distance ourselves from institutions and kind of let them run by themselves, we mm-hmm. see that they're just self-perpetuating machines that are going to get away from what we all agree on is basic morality.
Yeah, exactly.
That they're people, as this movie states. Like, this is who you're dealing with in the legal system, people.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week.